In Stockholm, on the 23rd of August, 1973, a criminal called Jan-Erik Olsson walks into a bank, pulls out a gun, and takes four bank workers hostage. He then demands a getaway car, cash, and for an accomplice to be freed from prison and rushed over to join him at the bank. Police snipers surround the bank. The criminals retreat with the hostages into the bank's vault. A policeman creeps inside and slams the vault door shut, blocking both hostages and captors inside. This is where it gets weird from inside the vault. One of the hostages, Kristen Enmark, phones the Swedish Prime Minister and begs for her captors to be allowed to escape. Bizarrely, she says she wants to go with them. The Prime Minister refuses. The police prepare to storm the vault. The criminals agreed to come out, but their hostages offered to act as human shields, protecting their captors from being shot. Later, the hostages would refuse to testify in court against them and even raised money for their defense. It seems the hostages have gone totally mad, siding with their captors rather than the police. This psychological response becomes known as Stockholm Syndrome. However, look a little closer, and you'll find the story is not so straightforward. In truth, Enmark had good cause to believe she was more likely to die in a shootout caused by trigger-happy police than to be killed by her captors, and so it was in her self-interest that the criminals be let go safely. Since 1973, the concept of Stockholm Syndrome has been reported by the media in numerous kidnapping and hostage incidents. But many are skeptical. It's not been recognized as an official psychiatric disorder. And in 1989, an FBI survey of 600 police agencies failed to register any kidnap cases where an emotional involvement between victim and kidnapper affected the rescue operation. In short, it's extremely rare. So could the real story of Stockholm Syndrome be that it's more about victim blaming than reality? In Stockholm, on the 23rd of August, 1973, a criminal called Jan-Erik Olsson walks into a bank, pulls out a gun, and takes four bank workers hostage. He then demands a getaway car, cash, and for an accomplice to be freed from prison and rushed over to join him at the bank. Police snipers surround the bank. The criminals retreat with the hostages into the bank's vault. A policeman creeps inside and slams the vault door shut, blocking both hostages and captors inside. This is where it gets weird from inside the vault. One of the hostages, Kristen Enmark, phones the Swedish Prime Minister and begs for her captors to be allowed to escape. Bizarrely, she says she wants to go with them. The Prime Minister refuses. The police prepare to storm the vault. The criminals agreed to come out, but their hostages offered to act as human shields, protecting their captors from being shot. Later, the hostages would refuse to testify in court against them and even raised money for their defense. It seems the hostages have gone totally mad, siding with their captors rather than the police. This psychological response becomes known as Stockholm Syndrome. However, look a little closer, and you'll find the story is not so straightforward. In truth, Enmark had good cause to believe she was more likely to die in a shootout caused by trigger-happy police than to be killed by her captors, and so it was in her self-interest that the criminals be let go safely. Since 1973, the concept of Stockholm Syndrome has been reported by the media in numerous kidnapping and hostage incidents. But many are skeptical. It's not been recognized as an official psychiatric disorder. And in 1989, an FBI survey of 600 police agencies failed to register any kidnap cases where an emotional involvement between victim and kidnapper affected the rescue operation. In short, it's extremely rare. So could the real story of Stockholm Syndrome be that it's more about victim blaming than reality? In Stockholm, on the 23rd of August, 1973, a criminal called Jan-Erik Olsson walks into a bank, pulls out a gun, and takes four bank workers hostage. He then demands a getaway car, cash, and for an accomplice to be freed from prison and rushed over to join him at the bank. Police snipers surround the bank. The criminals retreat with the hostages into the bank's vault. A policeman creeps inside and slams the vault door shut, blocking both hostages and captors inside. This is where it gets weird from inside the vault. One of the hostages, Kristen Enmark, phones the Swedish Prime Minister and begs for her captors to be allowed to escape. Bizarrely, she says she wants to go with them. The Prime Minister refuses. The police prepare to storm the vault. The criminals agreed to come out, but their hostages offered to act as human shields, protecting their captors from being shot. Later, the hostages would refuse to testify in court against them and even raised money for their defense. It seems the hostages have gone totally mad, siding with their captors rather than the police. This psychological response becomes known as Stockholm Syndrome. However, look a little closer, and you'll find the story is not so straightforward. In truth, Enmark had good cause to believe she was more likely to die in a shootout caused by trigger-happy police than to be killed by her captors, and so it was in her self-interest that the criminals be let go safely. Since 1973, the concept of Stockholm Syndrome has been reported by the media in numerous kidnapping and hostage incidents. But many are skeptical. It's not been recognized as an official psychiatric disorder. And in 1989, an FBI survey of 600 police agencies failed to register any kidnap cases where an emotional involvement between victim and kidnapper affected the rescue operation. In short, it's extremely rare. So could the real story of Stockholm Syndrome be that it's more about victim blaming than reality?
So for ages, it's been a total headache for many of those trying to save enough for a deposit to buy their first home. High rents alongside high house prices mean getting enough put aside each month is a real struggle. Now, higher mortgage rates have unfortunately added an extra hurdle.
It feels like the mountains get bigger constantly, like I'm putting in and then you have to take out because there's more expenses coming in so you can't put as much in.
Even if you've got your deposit together, loads more people are failing affordability checks for mortgages on properties they would have been able to manage 18 months ago. I'm Coletta Smith, the BBC's cost of living correspondent, and this is 5 minutes on Your First Home.
I'm 25. I live in Warrington, but I work in Manchester, Trafford, to be precise.
This is Ebony Cropper, and we're catching up on her lunch break.
I'm a business coordinator for a financial wellness company, and I'm currently engaged to my partner saving to buy a house and get married.
How easy is it to save at all at the moment?
Shopping bills have gone up 25% in the last 18 months compared to usual. And then because everyone's mortgage price is going up, my rent price is going up, so it's reducing what I can save. I'm fortunate that I can save a little bit, but not as much as I'd like. Plus all so the other bills.
Has your rent gone up this year then?
Yeah, literally in August it went up by £45 a month.
Are you saving at the moment, and where are you sort of saving that into?
It varies. So I have a Help to Buy ISA, so I'll try and get £150 to £200 a month if that were possible. Sometimes if I have like a car payment coming out, that's not always viable. But then I am just saving in my monthly budget, just trying to cut down on takeaways or clothes shopping, and just seeing where I can bite the budget a little bit, going for food and whatnot.
How important is buying a house to you and your partner, you know, in terms of that life plan?
It's my main goal, because I think having that ownership of something yourself and getting on the property ladder earlier, because obviously then you've got your mortgage for 25 years roughly, is so important, because I want my own space. My guilty pleasure is flat pack furniture and DIY. So any opportunity now I get where I can buy a house and just do it all fully will be amazing. Wow. But it's just
drunk around my just start constructing some furniture.
But it's just starting that life together. We're not planning on children just yet, but like that's a factor in the future. If we do decide to have them, then we're going to need the space for children.
Does it feel like all those life decisions are then being sort of like pushed into the future?
Yeah, like we got engaged this year, but then just think that's got to wait, because that's quite a big expense as it is for one day. And the house is more important. So like that's delayed because we've got to save for a house. I'm mid-20s and I'm not where I thought I'd be when I was 18 planning, compared to where I am now.
The boss of Leeds Building Society is called Richard Fearon, and they're one of the biggest lenders to first-time buyers. And just have a listen to his explanation of what's happening right now.
First-time buyers are bearing the brunt of higher rates. As much as anything, it's very, very bad luck in terms of timing. But they all are also carrying the can for not building enough houses, and that's manifesting in higher house prices. And that's a really toxic combination, high house prices and high rates.
And that is the mountain which Ebony and thousands like her are currently trying to climb.
It just feels a bit futile at the moment, because your goals are getting further and further away, because the prices and the interest rates are getting further and further away at the moment. And I know it has slowed currently, but compared to the 2.0% it was a few, like in 2021, to up to 6% now is struggle. And to get a reasonable size place as well is a lot more expensive than it used to be when I was originally looking.
Feels like the goalposts are shifting for you all the time.
Constantly.
And the government and the Bank of England are obviously saying, listen, it's important to put interest rates up to try and actually curb spending, and they're hoping that's going to bring prices down. But does it feel like that's sort of kicking you in the teeth in the process?
A little bit. Like I do understand the decisions have to be made, and interest rates do have to rise in different places, but I think as a young person who has them goals, it does feel like it's a struggle on the ground to get a reasonable house. I'm going to be looking at about £200,000. So that's £20,000 to save for a deposit minimum, plus then you've got your interest. And I'm like, oh, I don't feel very confident nor comfortable at my sort of goals and my future.
Thanks very much for listening. So for ages, it's been a total headache for many of those trying to save enough for a deposit to buy their first home. High rents alongside high house prices mean getting enough put aside each month is a real struggle. Now, higher mortgage rates have unfortunately added an extra hurdle.
It feels like the mountains get bigger constantly. Like I'm putting in and then you have to take out because there's more expenses coming in, so you can't put as much in.
Even if you've got your deposit together, loads more people are failing affordability checks for mortgages on properties they would have been able to manage 18 months ago. I'm Coletta Smith, the BBC's cost of living correspondent, and this is 5 Minutes On, Your First Home.
I'm 25. I live in Warrington, but I work in Manchester, Trafford, to be precise.
This is Ebony Cropper, and we're catching up on her lunch break.
I'm a business coordinator for a financial wellness company, and I'm currently engaged to my partner, saving to buy a house and get married.
How easy is it to save at all at the moment?
Shopping bills have gone up 25% in the last 18 months compared to usual. And then because everyone's mortgage price is going up, my rent price is going up, so it's reducing what I can save. I'm fortunate that I can save a little bit, but not as much as I'd like. Plus all the other bills.
Has your rent gone up this year then?
Yeah, literally in August it went up by £45 a month.
Are you saving at the moment, and where are you sort of saving that into?
It varies. So I have a Help to Buy ISA, so I'll try and get £150 to £200 a month if that were possible. Sometimes if I have like a car payment coming out, that's not always viable. But then I am just saving in my monthly budget, just trying to cut down on takeaways or clothes shopping, and just seeing where I can bite the budget a little bit, going for food and whatnot.
How important is buying a house to you and your partner, you know, in terms of that life plan?
It's my main goal, because I think having that ownership of something yourself and getting on the property ladder earlier, because obviously then you've got your mortgage for 25 years roughly, is so important, because I want my own space. My guilty pleasure is flat pack furniture and DIY, so any opportunity now I get where I can buy a house and just do it all fully will be amazing. But it's just,
do you want to come around my start constructing some furniture?
But it's just starting that life together. We're not planning on children just yet, but like, that's a factor in the future. If we do decide to have them, then we're going to need the space for children.
Does it feel like all those life decisions are then being sort of like pushed into the future?
Yeah, we got engaged this year, but then I just think that's got to wait, because that's quite a big expense as it is for one day. And the house is more important. So like, that's delayed because we've got to save for a house. I'm mid-20s and I'm not where I thought I'd be when I was 18 planning, compared to where I am now.
The boss of Leeds Building Society is called Richard Fearon, and they're one of the biggest lenders to first-time buyers. And just have a listen to his explanation of what's happening right now.
First-time buyers are bearing the brunt of higher rates. As much as anything, it's very, very bad luck in terms of timing. But they all are also carrying the can for not building enough houses, and that's manifesting in higher house prices. And that's a really toxic combination, high house prices and high rates.
And that is the mountain which Ebony and thousands like her are currently trying to climb.
It just feels a bit futile at the moment, because your goals getting further and further away, because the prices and the interest rates are getting further and further away at the moment. And I know it has slowed currently, but compared to the 2.0% it was for you, like in 2021, to up to 6% now is struggle. And to get a reasonable size place as well is a lot more expensive than it used to be when I was originally looking.
Feels like the goalposts are shifting for you all the time.
Constantly.
And the government and the Bank of England are obviously saying, listen, it's important to put interest rates up to try and actually curb spending, and they're hoping that's going to bring prices down. But does it feel like that's sort of kicking you in the teeth in the process?
A little bit. Like, I do understand the decisions have to be made, and interest rates do have to rise in different places, but I think as a young person who has them goals, it does feel like it's a struggle on the ground to get a reasonable house. I'm going to be looking at about £200,000. So that's £20,000 to save for a deposit minimum, plus then you've got your interest. And I'm like, oh, I don't feel very confident nor comfortable at my sort of goals and my future.
Thanks very much for listening. So for ages, it's been a total headache for many of those trying to save enough for a deposit to buy their first home. High rents alongside high house prices mean getting enough put aside each month is a real struggle. Now, higher mortgage rates have unfortunately added an extra hurdle.
It feels like the mountains get bigger constantly. Like, I'm putting in and then you have to take out because there's more expenses coming in, so you can't put as much in.
Even if you've got your deposit together, loads more people are failing affordability checks for mortgages on properties they would have been able to manage 18 months ago. I'm Coletta Smith, the BBC's cost of living correspondent, and this is 5 minutes on Your First Home.
I'm 25. I live in Warrington, but I work in Manchester, Trafford, to be precise.
This is Ebony Cropper, and we're catching up on her lunch break.
I'm a business coordinator for a financial wellness company, and I'm currently engaged to my partner, saving to buy a house and get married.
How easy is it to save at all at the moment?
Shopping bills have gone up 25% in the last 18 months compared to usual. And then because everyone's mortgage price is going up, my rent price is going up, so it's reducing what I can save. I'm fortunate that I can save a little bit, but not as much as I'd like. Plus all the other bills.
Has your rent gone up this year then?
Yeah, literally in August it went up by £45 a month.
Are you saving at the moment, and where are you sort of saving that into?
It varies. So I have a Help to Buy ISA, so I'll try and get £150 to £200 a month if that were possible. Sometimes if I have like a car payment coming out, that's not always viable. But then I am just saving in my monthly budget, just trying to cut down on takeaways or clothes shopping, and just seeing where I can bite the budget a little bit, going for food and whatnot.
How important is buying a house to you and your partner, you know, in terms of that life plan?
It's my main goal, because I think having that ownership of something yourself and getting on the property ladder earlier, because obviously then you've got your mortgage for 25 years roughly, is so important, because I want my own space. My guilty pleasure is flat pack furniture and DIY. So any opportunity now I get where I can buy a house and just do it all fully will be amazing.
Wow.
But it's just
drunk around my just constructing some furniture.
But it's just starting that life together. We're not planning on children just yet, but like, that's a factor in the future. If we do decide to have them, then we're going to need the space for children.
Does it feel like all those life decisions are then being sort of like pushed into the future?
Yeah, like we got engaged this year, but then I just think that's got to wait, because that's quite a big expense as it is for one day. And the house is more important. So like, that's delayed because we've got to save for a house. I'm mid-20s and I'm not where I thought I'd be when I was 18 planning, compared to where I am now.
The boss of Leeds Building Society is called Richard Fearon, and they're one of the biggest lenders to first-time buyers. And just have a listen to his explanation of what's happening right now.
First-time buyers are bearing the brunt of higher rates. As much as anything, it's very, very bad luck in terms of timing. But they all are also carrying the can for not building enough houses, and that's manifesting in higher house prices. And that's a really toxic combination, high house prices and high rates.
And that is the mountain which Ebony and thousands like her are currently trying to climb.
It just feels a bit futile at the moment, because your goal's getting further and further away, because the prices and the interest rates are getting further and further away at the moment. And I know it has slowed currently, but compared to the 2.0% it was for you, like in 2021, to up to 6% now is struggle. And to get a reasonable size place as well is a lot more expensive than it used to be when I was originally looking.
Feels like the goalposts are shifting for you all the time.
Constantly.
And the government and the Bank of England are obviously saying, listen, it's important to put interest rates up to try and actually curb spending, and they're hoping that's going to bring prices down. But does it feel like that's sort of kicking you in the teeth in the process?
A little bit. Like, I do understand the decisions have to be made and interest rates do have to rise in different places, but I think as a young person who has them goals, it does feel like it's a struggle on the ground to get a reasonable house. I'm going to be looking at about £200,000. So that's £20,000 to save for a deposit minimum, plus then you've got your interest. And I'm like, oh, I don't feel very confident nor comfortable at my sort of goals and my future.
Thanks very much for listening.
Since humanity's earliest days, we've been plagued by countless disease-causing pathogens. Invisible and persistent, these microorganisms and the illnesses they incur have killed more humans than anything else in history. But which disease is deadliest varies across time and place. Because while the march of progress has made us safer from some infectious threats, human innovation often exposes us to surprising new maladies. Our tour of history's deadliest diseases begins when humans lived in small hunter-gatherer communities. The illnesses these pre-agricultural nomads encountered most likely came from the various animals they ate and the soil and water they interacted with. There are no written records to help us identify these diseases. However, some illnesses leave distinct growths or lesions on the skeleton, allowing bioarchaeologists to diagnose ancient remains. And researchers have found that bones from this era suggest the presence of tuberculosis and treponemal infections. While these conditions are life-threatening, the deadliest diseases are invariably part of widespread epidemics, and there's no evidence of any large-scale outbreaks in this lengthy pre-agricultural period. However, when humans started developing agriculture around 12,000 years ago, it brought a whole new crop of diseases. Early farmers knew little about waste and water management, setting the stage for diarrheal diseases like dysentery. Much worse, the proliferation of open fields and irrigation created standing pools of water, which brought mosquitoes and in turn, malaria. We don't know exactly how many early farmers malaria killed, or how many it left vulnerable to other lethal infections, but we do know this mosquito-borne illness continued to spread through humanity's next major development, urbanization. In small communities, infectious diseases like measles and smallpox can only circulate so long before running out of hosts. But in densely populated regions with high birth rates, fast-evolving viruses like the flu can continually infect new individuals and morph into various strains. When large settlements became common, medical science hadn't advanced enough to effectively treat or even distinguish these variants, nor was it prepared to deal with one of the deadliest pandemics of all time, the Black Death. From the 1330s to the 1350s, the bubonic plague swept Asia, Africa, and Europe, reducing the global population from 475 million to roughly 350 million. Like most Afro-Eurasian diseases, the plague didn't cross the Atlantic until Europeans did in the late 1400s. But at the height of the plague in Europe, Asia, and North Africa, infection was almost guaranteed, and the plague's fatality rate ranged from 30 to 75%. However, the illness wasn't equally distributed among the population. Many wealthy lords and landowners were able to stay safe by hiding away in their spacious homes. As medical knowledge became more robust, this kind of class disparity began reflecting who had access to medical care, and that divide became particularly apparent during the reign of our next deadly disease. By the beginning of the 19th century, tuberculosis was already one of the most common causes of death in Europe and the Americas. But the Industrial Revolution led to working and living conditions that were overcrowded and poorly ventilated, turning TB into an epidemic that killed a quarter of Europe's adult population. The unhealthiest environments were largely populated by impoverished individuals who often went untreated while doctors provided wealthier victims with the era's most cutting-edge care. Throughout the 20th century, vaccines became common in many countries, even eradicating the centuries-old viral threat of smallpox. The advent of vaccination, alongside improvements in nutrition and hygiene, have helped people live longer lives on average. And today, medical advances in rapid testing and mRNA vaccines can help us tackle new outbreaks in record time. However, countless regions around the world remain unable to access vaccines, leaving them vulnerable to older threats. Malaria still takes the lives of over 600,000 people every year, with 96% of deaths occurring in communities across Africa. Tuberculosis continues to infect millions, almost half of whom live in Southeast Asia. Addressing these ailments and those yet to emerge will require scientists to develop new and more effective medicines, but something governments and healthcare systems can do today is working to make the treatments we have already accessible to all. Since humanity's earliest days, we've been plagued by countless disease-causing pathogens. Invisible and persistent, these microorganisms and the illnesses they incur have killed more humans than anything else in history. But which disease is deadliest varies across time and place. Because while the march of progress has made us safer from some infectious threats, human innovation often exposes us to surprising new maladies. Our tour of history's deadliest diseases begins when humans lived in small hunter-gatherer communities. The illnesses these pre-agricultural nomads encountered most likely came from the various animals they ate and the soil and water they interacted with. There are no written records to help us identify these diseases. However, some illnesses leave distinct growths or lesions on the skeleton, allowing bioarchaeologists to diagnose ancient remains. And researchers have found that bones from this era suggest the presence of tuberculosis and treponemal infections. While these conditions are life-threatening, the deadliest diseases are invariably part of widespread epidemics, and there's no evidence of any large-scale outbreaks in this lengthy pre-agricultural period. However, when humans started developing agriculture around 12,000 years ago, it brought a whole new crop of diseases. Early farmers knew little about waste and water management, setting the stage for diarrheal diseases like dysentery. Much worse, the proliferation of open fields and irrigation created standing pools of water, which brought mosquitoes and, in turn, malaria. We don't know exactly how many early farmers malaria killed, or how many it left vulnerable to other lethal infections, but we do know this mosquito-borne illness continued to spread through humanity's next major development, urbanization. In small communities, infectious diseases like measles and smallpox can only circulate so long before running out of hosts. But in densely populated regions with high birth rates, fast-evolving viruses like the flu can continually infect new individuals and morph into various strains. When large settlements became common, medical science hadn't advanced enough to effectively treat or even distinguish these variants, nor was it prepared to deal with one of the deadliest pandemics of all time, the Black Death. From the 1330s to the 1350s, the bubonic plague swept Asia, Africa, and Europe, reducing the global population from 475 million to roughly 350 million. Like most Afro-Eurasian diseases, the plague didn't cross the Atlantic until Europeans did in the late 1400s. But at the height of the plague in Europe, Asia, and North Africa, infection was almost guaranteed, and the plague's fatality rate ranged from 30 to 75%. However, the illness wasn't equally distributed among the population. Many wealthy lords and landowners were able to stay safe by hiding away in their spacious homes. As medical knowledge became more robust, this kind of class disparity began reflecting who had access to medical care, and that divide became particularly apparent during the reign of our next deadly disease. By the beginning of the 19th century, tuberculosis was already one of the most common causes of death in Europe and the Americas. But the Industrial Revolution led to working and living conditions that were overcrowded and poorly ventilated, turning TB into an epidemic that killed a quarter of Europe's adult population. The unhealthiest environments were largely populated by impoverished individuals who often went untreated while doctors provided wealthier victims with the era's most cutting-edge care. Throughout the 20th century, vaccines became common in many countries, even eradicating the centuries-old viral threat of smallpox. The advent of vaccination, alongside improvements in nutrition and hygiene, have helped people live longer lives on average. And today, medical advances in rapid testing and mRNA vaccines can help us tackle new outbreaks in record time. However, countless regions around the world remain unable to access vaccines, leaving them vulnerable to older threats. Malaria still takes the lives of over 600,000 people every year, with 96% of deaths occurring in communities across Africa. Tuberculosis continues to infect millions, almost half of whom live in Southeast Asia. Addressing these ailments and those yet to emerge will require scientists to develop new and more effective medicines, but something governments and healthcare systems can do today is working to make the treatments we have already accessible to all. Since humanity's earliest days, we've been plagued by countless disease-causing pathogens. Invisible and persistent, these microorganisms and the illnesses they incur have killed more humans than anything else in history. But which disease is deadliest varies across time and place. Because while the march of progress has made us safer from some infectious threats, human innovation often exposes us to surprising new maladies. Our tour of history's deadliest diseases begins when humans lived in small hunter-gatherer communities. The illnesses these pre-agricultural nomads encountered most likely came from the various animals they ate and the soil and water they interacted with. There are no written records to help us identify these diseases. However, some illnesses leave distinct growths or lesions on the skeleton, allowing bioarchaeologists to diagnose ancient remains. And researchers have found that bones from this era suggest the presence of tuberculosis and treponemal infections. While these conditions are life-threatening, the deadliest diseases are invariably part of widespread epidemics, and there's no evidence of any large-scale outbreaks in this lengthy pre-agricultural period. However, when humans started developing agriculture around 12,000 years ago, it brought a whole new crop of diseases. Early farmers knew little about waste and water management, setting the stage for diarrheal diseases like dysentery. Much worse, the proliferation of open fields and irrigation created standing pools of water, which brought mosquitoes and, in turn, malaria. We don't know exactly how many early farmers malaria killed, or how many it left vulnerable to other lethal infections, but we do know this mosquito-borne illness continued to spread through humanity's next major development, urbanization. In small communities, infectious diseases like measles and smallpox can only circulate so long before running out of hosts. But in densely populated regions with high birth rates, fast-evolving viruses like the flu can continually infect new individuals and morph into various strains. When large settlements became common, medical science hadn't advanced enough to effectively treat or even distinguish these variants, nor was it prepared to deal with one of the deadliest pandemics of all time, the Black Death. From the 1330s to the 1350s, the bubonic plague swept Asia, Africa, and Europe, reducing the global population from 475 million to roughly 350 million. Like most Afro-Eurasian diseases, the plague didn't cross the Atlantic until Europeans did in the late 1400s. But at the height of the plague in Europe, Asia, and North Africa, infection was almost guaranteed, and the plague's fatality rate ranged from 30 to 75%. However, the illness wasn't equally distributed among the population. Many wealthy lords and landowners were able to stay safe by hiding away in their spacious homes. As medical knowledge became more robust, this kind of class disparity began reflecting who had access to medical care, and that divide became particularly apparent during the reign of our next deadly disease. By the beginning of the 19th century, tuberculosis was already one of the most common causes of death in Europe and the Americas. But the Industrial Revolution led to working and living conditions that were overcrowded and poorly ventilated, turning TB into an epidemic that killed a quarter of Europe's adult population. The unhealthiest environments were largely populated by impoverished individuals who often went untreated while doctors provided wealthier victims with the era's most cutting-edge care. Throughout the 20th century, vaccines became common in many countries, even eradicating the centuries-old viral threat of smallpox. The advent of vaccination, alongside improvements in nutrition and hygiene, have helped people live longer lives on average. And today, medical advances in rapid testing and mRNA vaccines can help us tackle new outbreaks in record time. However, countless regions around the world remain unable to access vaccines, leaving them vulnerable to older threats. Malaria still takes the lives of over 600,000 people every year, with 96% of deaths occurring in communities across Africa. Tuberculosis continues to infect millions, almost half of whom live in Southeast Asia. Addressing these ailments and those yet to emerge will require scientists to develop new and more effective medicines, but something governments and healthcare systems can do today is working to make the treatments we have already accessible to all.